The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
For the last few weeks, I've been talking about the Eightfold Path, which is the guidelines, the tasks, essentially, or the direction that we're encouraged to move as we engage in our practice. And the eight aspects of the Eightfold Path are typically, or a common translation for these eight aspects are wise understanding, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. And the other day, Stephen Batchelor was here speaking, and he talked quite a bit about the Eightfold Path. And he provided an alternative translation that I actually found quite uplifting. Looking at the Eightfold Path as really being our way of moving in the world, not just as something to kind of trudge along with, but as an unfolding process, a work in progress, essentially, of how we just engage and act in the world. And he said that the Eightfold Path is about appropriate seeing, thinking, speaking, acting, working, engaging, recollecting, and concentrating. To me, that kind of made it feel a little more active, putting the verb into that form. So in the last week I talked a little bit about the first aspect of the section of the Eightfold Path that relates to ethics. Within the Eightfold Path, there's roughly three sections. There's a section on ethics, a section on development of the mind, or concentration, meditation section, and then there's a section on wisdom. And so the ethics section consists of the three aspects of wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood, or, as Stephen says, appropriate speaking, acting, and working. So this aspect of this ethical component of the Eightfold Path, which is essentially the path that guides us towards happiness. It supports our letting go of those things that kind of stick us and catch us into our habitual tendencies, our habitual patterns, that tend to lead us into suffering over and over again, the conditioned patterns of our minds. It takes some active work to uproot those conditions. As I mentioned in the guided meditation, that when you get lost in thought, when the mind is off, wandering off in thought, your conditioned habits and patterns are kind of running the show. And then when mindfulness comes in, the aspect of mindfulness comes back, we have the opportunity to choose how to engage. And so that this is essentially the direction that the Eightfold Path is pointing us to, away from the kind of automatic reactivity that we have conditioned into us, towards the more appropriate choices that will tend to lead us towards more skillful actions, which tends to lead us towards being happier in our lives. So this ethical component isn't in the Buddhist way of thinking about it. It's not about right and wrong in the normal way that we usually think of morality, that there's some sort of external judge that decides what's right and wrong, and that we kind of have to just follow that. It's about practically what actions tend to make us happy and what actions tend to make us suffer. Those actions that create harm and suffering to ourselves and others are said to be unskillful. They don't support happiness. They don't support freedom. So this ethical teaching is basically about what supports moving away from suffering and towards freedom from suffering. So if we think about ethics from this standpoint, it's basically a teaching about connecting with others. It's an aspect of this Eightfold Path that brings us into relationship with the world, guiding our relationships towards peacefulness, towards harmony. So that's a benefit of this aspect of the Eightfold Path, that our relationships become more harmonious, our minds become more peaceful, we live more at ease. Partly because we are not acting in ways that cause us regret, that cause us to think back and wish we hadn't done things, or to endlessly spin in our minds about ways we've behaved. The mind can come to rest when we use these guidelines to guide our actions. So the ethical component, if we're following these suggestions of acting in these ways, is said to lead us to the bliss of blamelessness. And we also are said to be offering the gift of fearlessness to others, because in acting in ways that are non-harming, essentially the entire underpinning of this aspect of ethics is non-harming. Both non-harming to self and other. So in acting in ways that are non-harming, any being that comes into our sphere need not be afraid of being harmed by us. So we offer the gift of fearlessness. So last week I talked about wise speech, or appropriate speaking. And today I'm going to talk about the other two aspects of the ethical section of the Eightfold Path: wise action and wise livelihood. So as with wise speech, the statements around both wise action and wise livelihood are around actions and livelihoods in general to avoid. So they're stated in the negative rather than in the positive. So with respect to wise action, the actions to avoid are we refrain from killing, refraining from taking that which is not given, and refraining from sexual misconduct. So wise action is really about reminding us to be aware of how we're using our bodies in the world. How are we behaving? How are we acting? So I want to go through each of these aspects of wise action. The first, refraining from killing. The Pali for this, panatipata veratmani, the veratmani part is the refraining part. Panatipata, the word breaks down into two parts. And pana basically means things that breathe. And the second part of the word, atipata, means to strike out. So the technical translation of that aspect of the precept is to refrain from striking out at things that breathe. So this precept basically includes human beings and all what we would basically call living beings, including animals and reptiles and birds and insects. I don't think in the time of the Buddha they would have thought about bacteria. I don't think they knew about bacteria, but the text that I was working with as I was preparing this said that, you know, breathing beings includes these particular categories. I don't know whether bacteria breathe or not. They must do something like that, but if we take it down to that level, this precept becomes impossible to fulfill. And it's challenging enough as it is if we take it down to the level of insects, mosquitoes, spiders, ants in our kitchen, etc. So it's refraining from killing living beings. Now again, the purpose behind this isn't some kind of injunction or it's not really in the frame of thou shalt not. It's more looking at what's happening in our minds, what is going on in our minds when we engage in the activity of killing. So this is actually pointing to, and included actually in the definition around this killing of beings, has to do with the intention to kill. So if you're not intending to kill something and you kill it, that is not considered wrong action because the intention is not there. It's about the mind. It's about the mind's movement towards wanting to get rid of something, towards that movement of aversion, that movement of hatred and hostility. That movement of mind, of hatred, of hostility, that generally motivates or is behind the intention to kill, that quality of mind is what leads us to suffering. And the intensity of that quality of mind, which moves into behavior, if the quality of mind is intense enough that it moves into behavior, it tends to be a very strong kind of animosity, of aversion that's in our minds. And that's what this practice is about looking at. It's about looking at that movement of the mind. So just consider, as an example in your own mind, the difference in what would be going on in your mind if you were walking across a lawn and not knowing that there was a spider walking through the grass, you stepped on the spider and killed it. And the difference in the quality of mind if you're sitting in your room and you see a spider on your wall and you pick up a shoe and hit it because you don't want that spider in your room. Just, you know, thinking about it, there's a difference in the mind. In the first case, there's not any wish to harm that being, that spider that happened to die as you walked across the lawn. In the second example, there is a wish to harm. So that's the area that we explore around this precept, is that movement towards harming. Now, that movement towards harming will arise. I mean, I think everybody who works with ants in their kitchen has that kind of movement to get rid of these things. They're just pests. So the practice practice is to see, can we refrain from following through on that intention? So if we can refrain from following through on that intention to kill, then we are engaging in the restraint that supports or counters that tendency of mind to harm. So in a sense, in that movement of restraining that intention, we are effectively cultivating the intention towards non-harming because we're refraining from following through on the intention to harm. So as a side effect, we're starting to cultivate an intention of non-harming. So this is the side of the other side of this this aspect of wise action, that as we engage in refraining from killing, we're simultaneously cultivating compassion. We're cultivating an openness of heart, a respect for life. So in my own experience, I found this to actually have an impact, that working with this practice of refraining from killing in my kitchen with my aunts, I found that as time went on, as I worked with these aunts, I began to have a sense of compassion for these beings. You know, that, and now actually the sense in my heart when I see pretty much any being moving or, you know, going about its day, I was seeing these slugs, like, you know, creeping across the path today and looking that there were a lot of ones that had been stepped on. You know, people had been careless and stepped on a lot of slugs. And there was this one that was kind of working its way through this mass of other slugs that had been stepped on. And I just felt this kind of opening, you know, a sense of, oh, that being is just doing its thing. It just wants to live and do its thing. So there comes to be, as you engage in this kind of a practice around non-killing, a respect for life and a sense of connection, a sense of connectedness with other beings. So there are gray areas in this exploration. And this may be an area we can have a discussion about later on. I think we should have some time, hopefully, for discussion. Areas where we each need to explore for ourselves around how do we work with this? So, for instance, you know, the whole bird flu thing where there was this mass killing of all of these chickens to prevent the spread of bird flu. So there's areas, or the use of pesticides to kill malarial mosquitoes so that children don't get malaria and die. So there's areas where it's not so clear, and along these lines there's a kind of an understanding of kind of gradations around the impact of this precept. So, for instance, it's less of a, we're actually looking mostly at how does this rebound on our minds? How does it rebound on our minds to kill? And so if we're engaging in this killing with aversion in our hearts, that has more of an impact on our mind stream. If we're engaging in an action such as hopefully putting to death these masses of chickens in a humane way, hopefully, with a sense of regret for their loss of life and compassion in our hearts for the people that may be saved from being infected by the bird flu, that's a different impact on the mind. So it's not a cut and dried kind of thing here around killing. It has to do with the mind state. It has to do with the intention that's in the mind. Now, the understanding is that there will be some kind of rebound if you kill with the intention to kill, there will be some kind of rebound on the mind stream. It may simply manifest as a feeling of regret, of feeling like, oh, I really feel really heavy and it feels painful to do this. That's a way that that might manifest, that kind of rebound might manifest that way. So there's no like cut and dried thing around, you know, if you do this, then you're going to hell. That's not the way it's understood in the Buddhist teachings. In fact, there's a teaching about a mass murderer during the time of the Buddha. His name was Angulimala, and he had killed 999 people violently, intentionally. At one point, he met the Buddha, and he was planning to kill the Buddha, which would have been really horrible karma, according to the understanding of the way things work, that if you kill somebody who's really, really virtuous, there's more impact on your mind. And the Buddha intervened and essentially, you know, stopped his mind and pointed out to him what he'd been doing. And that mass murderer became a monk and practiced with the Buddha. And it is said he became fully awakened, fully enlightened. Now I can only imagine how his meditation must have proceeded after having killed 999 people, sitting in mindfulness, sitting in concentration, settling the mind, images. I can just imagine images of these people coming into his mind. That was the way it rebounded on his mind stream. There's even a story a little bit later on, because the people in the villages around the area didn't like to give him alms food because they remembered him as a mass murderer, and you know they still hated him, and when he would go through town they would throw things at him and they wouldn't give him any food. And he came back and reported this to the Buddha, and the Buddha said, "Bear it, Angulimala. You're suffering in a small way now for that which you might have burned in hell for millions of years." that essentially the understanding is that we can purify this unskillful mind, even if it has been immersed in that kind of direction that's just so off course. To me, I find this teaching inspiring. Anytime I myself feel like I'm not worthy to be awakened, I remember this story of Angulimala and realize that whatever I've done, I've not done anything like that. And if that possibility exists for someone like that, it exists for all of us. Actually, it's said that there are some things you can do that will make it impossible to get enlightened in this lifetime. Doesn't cut it off forever, but it's said that if you kill your mother or your father, that will make you suffer very deeply. So we engage in this practice and cultivate compassion as we avoid following through on an intention to kill. The second aspect is refraining from taking that which is not given. And again, the definition of this has to do with the intention underneath. It's got to do with essentially following through on the intention to take something that does not belong to you. So in this definition, in this exploration, there's a couple of pieces that come together in order to make it wrong action. To make it intentionally stealing, one has to have the intention to steal. the intention to take something from somebody, and you have to have the understanding or the perception that that thing belongs to somebody. So that we have to perceive the thing as belonging to somebody. So, for example, if you're walking down the street and, you know, picking flowers on bushes, as I did this when I first moved to California, there were all these flowers everywhere. And, you know, right at the edge of the street, there were all of these plants, and I was just picking the flowers. And at some point, I realized that these were not public property, that these actually belonged to people. And at that point, I stopped picking flowers. You know, it's like I didn't know that they hadn't belonged, that they had belonged to people. So that is not what would be considered wrong action. It's not stealing because there's not the perception that it is belonging to somebody. So again, there are some gradations here around this precept. And again, it has to do with the what happens in our minds as we move to want to have things that others possess, and move to if we actually go to the place of taking something that belongs to somebody, if we take from somebody who is, again, it said if taking from somebody who is very spiritually developed is more unwholesome than taking from someone who is a murderer or something, you know, somebody who has a less wholesome mind. And it's also seems to be more of a rebound on our minds if we take something that we think is very valuable. That the movement towards that taking, the kind of impulse behind that, wanting to have that thing, the greed around it, is stronger. And therefore, it's more, you know, the way that these things work, the way greed and aversion work, is the stronger they are, and the more we act on them as they're strong, they just get stronger and stronger. And so if we have a strong pull to take something that's extremely valuable and we act on it, that is strengthening that movement of mind to keep having what we want as opposed to resting content with what we have. So the positive side of this, that as we refrain from acting, taking things that are not given, we cultivate that sense of contentment. Sense of contentment with just what we have. We also cultivate honesty. Again, there's some subtleties here to think about in your own experience. It seems pretty easy to take things from work, you know, office supplies to use at home. Is that really offered? Is it an understanding that the company is offering those that you can use for your home use? So there's some places again to look at the more subtle levels of this precept. I don't think any of us are going to be going out to rob a bank or to break into somebody's home. But there are some places where perhaps we can refine our understanding of this and look at the movement of mind that moves us into that, that movement of greed, of wanting, of not being contented with what we have. The third aspect of wise action is refraining from sexual misconduct. And as the basis of understanding about the these aspects of wise action is refraining from harming, this is really about looking at how to refrain from causing harm through our sexuality. The technical definition in the suttas is basically about refraining from adultery. But the context of the precept is cultural. I mean, it it's got enough flexibility in a way to, it doesn't, for instance, prevent any kind of sexual relations outside of marriage. It's not about that. It's about honoring commitments that we've made with people, honoring contracts. In some cultures, the contracts can be, at the time of the Buddha, I believe that one man could have many wives. And that was fine. That was within that culture. So in our culture, we have much more of a sense of, well, it's different for each of us. But I think what we need to look at is honoring the understandings and the contracts that we have with our partners. And to really look also at that issue around non-harming. Because even if we have a contract with somebody that says, yes, we can have multiple sexual partners, are both people in the relationship really completely, absolutely comfortable with that? And everybody else? Is there absolutely no harm being done here? To me, that's questionable. I was personally in a relationship at one point where that was kind of the understanding, and it was very painful. Even though it was understood, and technically the contract wasn't being broken, it was very painful. So, you know, I personally have found that, you know, just that look at the non-harming aspect around sexuality. Sexuality is such a powerful energy, and it's so easy to use it to manipulate, and it's also a very powerful energy that can be hard to restrain at times. And so looking at the non-harming aspect as a way to cultivate some restraint around it. And we don't really want to harm others, but our sexual energy is so potent that it kind of overrides that concern about harming at times. And we delude ourselves into thinking, oh, this isn't going to harm anybody. So really being honest around that aspect of non-harming with respect to looking at sexual misconduct. And also recognize and look at whether in engaging in your sexual relationships, if there's any lying going on, then there's a breach of another aspect of ethics. If you're lying about something, there's wrong speech going on. So working with this precept cultivates respect, cultivates renunciation, and cultivates fidelity, cultivates that sense of trust between people within a committed relationship. So those are the three aspects of wise action. Moving into wise livelihood, the other aspect of the ethical component of the Eightfold Path. Essentially, at its basic understanding, wise livelihood is livelihood that does not violate any of the precepts on speech or action. So if you find in your work, or if you find that there is a, if you are engaged in work that requires you to lie or engage in harsh speech, to speak abusively or divisively, if it requires you to kill or steal, it's not wise livelihood. So it's basically livelihood that doesn't violate wise speech and wise action. There are some additional occupations at the time of the Buddha that the Buddha said, these are also ones you should avoid. And you could potentially, in engaging in these, not technically be breaking any of the other aspects of wise speech or wise action. But they're seen as inherently leading towards harm. And these include trading in weapons, trading in living beings, which includes slavery, trading in meat, trading in intoxicants, and trading in poisons. So my understanding of this is basically to look at whether our jobs require us to violate some of these ethical underpinnings. And if they do, and we're finding a sense of conflict for ourselves with the path, I mean, we all have to make our own choices around this. There's some potentially confusing issues around this area. I mean, thinking about police officers, for instance. I was asked a question some months ago around somebody who had been working with a police officer who had ended up having to kill someone in the line of duty. And they were that person was apparently struggling quite a lot around it. And, if you're on a spiritual path and you find yourself in a kind of a place where your job is requiring you to act in ways that are counter to your spiritual path, that probably requires some deep reflection on whether that occupation is one that is appropriate for you. The understanding around refraining from killing, again, as I said, it's about the intention. And so if in moving towards being in a profession like police officer or something, if you engage in that profession and you can in your heart know that you are not intending to try to kill someone when you have to try to stop them, aim at the leg or something to try to prevent from killing them, that the intention is not to kill. That's an area that we can work with this kind of practice. But again, this can be a very challenging kind of exploration. And as with the other areas, there are some gray areas. So in this day and age in particular, it seems like the, talking about trading in weapons, for instance, the manufacture of computers, the computers can be used for waging war. And now, as I understand it, there's all these robots that they're using in Afghanistan. People just sit at computers to do this. And so the computers themselves are being used for unethical purposes. And yet computers have also been used for very ethical purposes. So the computer is a kind of a neutral thing. And looking at the intention, if you're in this field of working with computers, looking at the intention behind the use that the computer that you're working on is going to be put to. is it essentially trading in weapons or is it trading in medical equipment? You know, the computers can just be such a wide range of things. So it again has to do with intention, looking back at what is the purpose of this work. So looking at these areas of wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, we start to really appreciate this training in non-harming and begin to understand that as we work with this, that there's not so much of a distinction between causing harm to others and causing harm to ourselves. That essentially, when we engage in activities that cause harm to others, we're harming ourselves through the mind states that we're in as we cause harm to others. So there's not so much of a distinction, and that cultivating the refraining from these unskillful actions rebounds on our mind and cultivates many beautiful qualities of mind. Wisdom is really the first beautiful quality that is really supported and cultivated by practicing these ethical aspects. Wisdom being an understanding of what leads us away from suffering. So this wisdom, we find that as we engage in these actions that are non-harming, we are moving away from suffering towards more freedom, towards more happiness. We cultivate compassion through refraining from killing, cultivate honesty through refraining from taking what's not given. We cultivate truthfulness through refraining from false speech. We cultivate kindness and compassion. Kindness also when we refrain from killing. We cultivate kindness when we refrain from abusive speech. We cultivate resolve as we resolve to act ethically. We cultivate generosity as we offer to other beings this gift of fearlessness. And we cultivate a clarity of mind as our mind is not agitated around how it's behaved and is no longer in a state of endlessly thinking about regret. Our minds become clear and peaceful. So the whole point of this ethical component of the path isn't about just blindly following rules and refraining from doing things by rote. It's really about cultivating these beautiful qualities, supporting that in our hearts. And then the last thing I'll say is what will lead us into next week, talking about wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration. That as we engage in these actions, it's said that we cultivate the wisdom. I'll read this. Right understanding comes first. We understand wrong action as wrong action and right action as right action. This is right understanding. And again, this is about that understanding what is skillful and unskillful. One makes an effort to abandon wrong action and to enter upon right action. This is right effort. Mindfully one abandons wrong action. Mindfully one enters upon right action. This is one's right mindfulness. These three states run and circle around right action. That is right understanding, right effort, and right mindfulness. So not only are we cultivating these beautiful qualities of compassion, honesty, truthfulness, patience, renunciation, resolve, clarity of mind, and generosity, we're also cultivating wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise understanding. So those are some thoughts around this ethical aspect of the Eightfold Path. And I'd like to hear from you. What is this raised from you? Raised in you, is this? Sometimes this can be a kind of uncomfortable topic. I'm curious what's in your minds. Yeah, in the back.
I've heard you speak about this before, and I remember a story you told about the ants in your kitchen.
I got a little more detailed that time, yes.
And we started having ants in our kitchen recently, and I thought of that. And I've been using a technique to try to get them to go someplace else instead of our kitchen. And I'm trying to convince my husband not to automatically kill them. We just want to try to make them, you know, stay away from the food.
Yes.
And but I wanted to let you know that there was a thoughtfulness about the decisions we were making around that used to be very automatic.
That's beautiful. And what was the feeling in your heart as you were doing that?
Well, there was an openness, I think, and just feeling very good about making that decision,
mm-hmm.
and stopping and thinking and being more aware of my actions and making a choice that way instead of automatically doing something that I had always done.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, for me, too, that engagement, just over and over again, refraining from that automatic movement that's just motivated a lot out of delusion. You know, it's like, oh, these beings aren't worth anything. You know, it's kind of like they're so small. You know, there's kind of this delusion around the value of their life. And, you know, just doing that refraining over and over again, it seemed to have a rebound effect on my heart. And I think that working with all these precepts has that kind of rebound effect. So thank you.
Thank you.
Speaking about ants, I've been thinking about this with ants, and my approach to them is, you know, that we're all here together and we're sharing this earth together, and I'd just appreciate it if you wouldn't, you know, to come in and be in my food. If we could just make a deal, you know, could we make a deal?
Yeah.
But it really helps me to feel like we're all one.
Yeah.
And to overcome this, you know, I'm better than you because I'm bigger and I have some, you know, and it helps me to feel my equality with everyone and everything, so.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, you know, I really actually appreciated my aunts. At one point, I realized they were really teaching me how to keep my kitchen clean. Now, if I left any little bit of food on the counter, phew, they'd be right there. If I kept everything clean, they didn't come. So, yeah. Yeah. So, I appreciated them as a teacher, in a sense. Yeah, thank you.
I was spending a couple hours this morning with our neighbor's cat. And what struck me is the level of fierceness that she can display and how close that can be to behavior which is very affectionate. And she can switch between these two like lightning.
Mm.
And I don't sense any anger in it. She's just a fierce animal. So I think the question that comes, it seems to be her nature to kill rodents. Would it be an ethical way to keep mice out of my house by having a cat?
You know, the injunction is around directly killing yourself. So, for instance, the Buddha was not a vegetarian. And actually, there are Buddhist countries where vegetarianism is not particularly practiced. Now, somebody is having to violate that movement around killing in that culture. But I think that the Buddha actually said to his monks that, and this actually created a schism in his community at one point. One of his monks said, look, we should not be eating meat. And, I'm the pure one because I say we shouldn't be eating meat, and so everybody should follow me. This was his cousin, Devadatta, who tried to kill the Buddha several times. So he tried to create this split in the Sangha around this issue around eating meat, and the Buddha refused to say we should refrain from eating meat altogether. He said, look, we are mendicants, and people are offering food to us, and if all they have to offer is what they're eating and it's meat, we should accept it and eat it. He did say that they should not eat, that his monks should not eat meat, or the monastics, the monks and nuns, should not eat meat if they knew it was killed explicitly for them. That they should refuse that meat. And so there is that, kind of care in that area. That's a kind of a delicate question. I mean, I had a cat for years, and she did kill some things. That wasn't why I had her. So, again, the intention is part of it. I mean, if you hate the rats and you get a cat in order to kill the rats, there's a kind of there's a karmic rebound on your mind because of the hatred of the rats.
So that if I were to let the cat and the mice have exactly the kind
of... Oh, yeah, use the mic, sorry.
So that if I were to let the cat and the mice have exactly the kind of relationship with each other that they would have if I were not involved. It's kind of the cat's nature to eat mice.
Yeah.
Kind of part of being a cat, I guess.
Yeah, it is unfortunately part of being a cat.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Mary.
So if this rests on our intention, and I think, Andrea, you might know what I'm already going to say, what if we pretend something's not happening that is happening?
Well, that's delusion. If we're in denial over something, that delusion is essentially masking an underlying intention. So can you go a little bit more into your question?
I would wish then that our Buddhists... communities, the sanghas all across this country could get together and say this whole country is deluded in supporting the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and God knows all the other stuff that we do. Because it's happening, and it's very painful to try to do something about it.
Yeah, the... This is a huge question around ethics, and I think this is an interesting point. I think thinking on in the time of the Buddha, and I think now monastics now are not allowed to engage in politics. You know, it's like they're required to not be engaged in politics. And I'm going to tell another story from the time of the Buddha. The Buddha was often talking to kings, and one story that particularly stuck in my mind was a time when this one king came to the Buddha and basically said to the Buddha that he was thinking about invading this particular country. No, it wasn't Ashoka. Ashoka was many, many hundreds of years after the Buddha. So this king was talking to the Buddha around invading a country, and he said that to the Buddha, and the Buddha didn't actually speak directly to the king. He turned to Ananda, his attendant, and said, "Ananda, I hear the citizens of that country engage in peaceful endeavors, that they treat their wives well, they treat their servants well, they have community relations, they meet in harmony and break up in harmony. Is that all true about this country?" And I can't remember all the things, but there were like seven aspects of a harmonious land. And Ananda said, "Yes, they do. They do all of those things." And then the Buddha said, "Well, then it will not be possible to overtake them by invading them. They're too strong. They're too cohesive." And the king in that moment realized he should not invade that country. But he went off and formed a plan to subvert that unity through propaganda so that he could then invade. So he used the information the Buddha gave him to do what he wanted to do. And in fact, the last thing the Buddha says to him is that the king says something like, I need to go to tend to something. And the Buddha says, "It is now time for you to do as you see fit." That basically, there's kind of this recognition that people have their karma. That we cannot always stop all of the destruction. And I think we also have to do what we can, move in the way that we move in the world, in ways that are non-harming, in ways that promote non-harming. And we all have different ways of manifesting that. Some people are demonstrators, other people are quiet and sit in caves. And I personally can't make a judgment between one or the other to say the person who's sitting in the cave is not doing his part towards peacefulness in the world. So I think we can't really necessarily judge from outer actions in terms of the direction that a particular being is. I mean, we can to some extent judge through outer actions, but we may have some idea that it means that everybody should engage in this way in order to have something stop. Whereas some people have that we all have different ways to engage in that wholesome movement, that wholesome direction. I don't know if that speaks to you, but and we need to stop because it's already after 9. So thank you for your questions.